Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the first day of impeachment hearings before the House Judiciary Committee, featuring four law professors and a lot of partisan sparring, which at the end of the day appears to be the Republican strategy to make the hearing so overheated with partisanship and alternative realities that the bulk of the population tunes it out and are left with the impression that the whole impeachment exercise is about partisanship, not presidential abuse of power. Corey Brettschneider, professor of political science at Brown University, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School and author of The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents, joins us. We'll discuss today's disagreement between dueling legal scholars over whether Trump's conduct met the constitutional threshold for removal of a duly elected president, which was largely ignored by Republican congressional questioners who made speeches condemning the whole process as a bitter partisan exercise, which the Democrats have been engaged in since Trump took office. With today's opening round of the House impeachment investigation exposing such a relentless onslaught of distraction from building a case against the president, which in a month or so will end up as a trial in the Senate, we'll assess whether, no matter how strong the case against Trump is, it won't be clear to a lot of Americans. Then we'll speak with John Storr, a contributing writer at the Washington Monthly and an editor and publisher of the editorial board, where he has an article, When Does Ordinary Republican Partisanship Turn into Treason? We'll discuss the extraordinary depth of dishonesty Republicans like Senator Kennedy and even the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee are sinking to in parroting the Russian line to try to shift the blame from Russia's proven meddling in the 2016 election onto the hapless Ukrainians whose country is under attack by Russia. Then finally, with an alarming report from the Global Carbon Project showing how 2019 has seen an increase in global greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels, we'll speak with Michael Clare, a five-college professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and the author of the new book just out, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. We'll examine the role of the Pentagon, which is planning for the catastrophic consequences of global warming, and how their reality-based efforts could influence global warming deniers. And joining us now is Corey Brettschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writing has appeared in The Time, Politico, and The New York Times, and he is the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Welcome to Background Briefing, Corey Brettschneider.
Thanks, Ian. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you, Corey. And in terms of a guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents, how about a guide to the Constitution for the average American watching today's hearings? You had four law professors, three of them chosen by the Democrats, one by the Republicans. And I'm not sure that it was really clear because nobody was listening, particularly the Republicans, to what they say. I mean, it was mostly about grandstanding. And did you get any clarity from it? I mean,
I hope the American people did. You know, I found it riveting, I have to say, but I'm biased. I'm a constitutional professor. This is my kind of thing. But I think that, you know, a lot of the things that you and I have been talking about now for some time, trying to explain to your listeners what's happening with impeachment, what the standard is here, and why, for instance, an impeachment rightly focuses on abuse of power, not just crimes. Really, it's a distinct category from crimes. Those points, which are familiar, I think, to your listeners from our conversations and from your other coverage, I think a lot of Americans don't know what impeachment is. So this was really a primer. It was a guide for the American people to the process of impeachment. And I was particularly impressed with Pam Karlan, who I thought was brilliant in really delivering, especially in the early couple of hours, a closing argument for why there really is an obligation of this Congress to impeach this president. And she did a beautiful job of tying together the abstract idea of high crimes and misdemeanors designed to stop abuse of power, but then tying it to the very specific actions of this president and explaining why, really for the Ukraine issue alone, but other issues came up as well, including the president's refusal to abide by subpoenas, why they are really require this Congress to act. And I thought, too, you know, there was a sort of stereotype of what a professor is I did another show where somebody was asking about whether this would backfire because it would look like a bunch of kind of academics trying to speak to the American people in a way that would have been boring to them. But the reality of what we saw, I thought, was anything but. Pam Karlan, in particular, did a brilliant job of pushing back on the ranking member who said to her, you were probably too busy to read the transcript or follow what's been going on. And she said, this is my job as a professional academic, as a law professor, prepare. And I know the facts. And it was a sharp rebuke to exactly what you're talking about, is sort of indifference from the Republicans on this committee to the brute facts and the brute reality that this president did abuse power.
But to my introduction and the question that struck me, which is, I see a fairly naked example of a strategy on the part of the Republicans to actually gin up partisanship, to make it more toxic, to make the friction greater, to obfuscate, to distract, and to turn the whole thing into what they keep saying is a witch hunt. You wanted to get this guy from day one, and this whole thing is a farce. And that was the refrain. Right. And I thought that maybe it has a wearying effect on the audience. That's the way I see their strategy. I just don't know whether it worked or not. It didn't work for you, obviously.
Yeah, right, or for either of us. But I guess my hope is that people will see through that. They began by saying there's no quid pro quo. And now what they're doing is attacking the witnesses. And when you lack an argument, when you can't win on the facts or the law, you attack the person, you try to dodge from the real issue. And that's what they're doing. And I just don't think it's going to work. There was a moment, for instance, where the First Lady tried to call out Pam Karlan for an example that she used that involved the word barren, and say that she was somehow attacking her son. Now, Karlan brilliantly just apologized and moved on. But they're going to, not stop with that. They'll attack the witnesses. They'll attack the Ivy Tower. They did it less, though, than I thought they would. At one point, the ranking member, Republican member, said basically that this was terrific testimony. I think he had to acknowledge that these are experts in the field. Some of them, the try to be polite about it, the less sophisticated members when it comes to these issues, did try to just weren't as respectful and did a bit rip into the experts and say, oh, it's just her opinion. But I think, when you start attacking the person, when you see how weak their arguments are, it's all the more evidence to the American people that this president did commit high crimes and misdemeanors, did abuse power. And it's a clarification that talking about narrow criminal statutes, that's not what this is about. It's about whether or not this president, in a brute way, tried to pressure the president of Ukraine to aid the American people in a U.S. election. And he did. And I think that's been clear from watching the Intelligence Committee and watching this. And I guess the other thing I'll just say is, this really was, from Karlan, like a closing argument of pulling it all together, weaving the facts with the law, and like a great lawyer explaining what the case against the president is. The difference, though, is that Professor Karlan's client here is the American people, and I think she served them really well.
And again, I'm speaking with Corey Brettschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as being a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writings appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times, and he's the author of the new book, The Oath in the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. So what kind of a job do you think the Republican chosen witness did? He was, I thought, from their point of view, he did a pretty good job. But I was surprised, or perhaps disappointed, that when Jonathan Turley sort of challenged the Democrats by saying, you're going too fast, this, you should get more witnesses. If I was Chairman Nadler, I would have said, well, that's a great idea. Why don't you help us and help your Republicans who put you on here as their spokesperson to get some witnesses, because we're trying to get them. We're trying to get the president. We're trying to get his chief of staff. We're trying to get his former national security advisor and his energy secretary. I just felt that in a way and then Norm Eisen really didn't even talk to Turley at all. It made it seem unnecessarily partisan on the part of the Democrats.
Yeah, it was a missed opportunity because, you know, he wasn't saying that the president had a perfect call or that the president is exonerated. That's not his view. His view is that we need more information. And he had views, too, like that obstruction of justice shouldn't be obstruction of Congress, I should say, shouldn't be one of the articles of impeachment. So they sort of brought out more the way that this testimony helped them. Norm Eisen did do that at one point by just saying, haven't you written that you don't need a criminal offense in order to have a high crime? And he said, I want a yes or no. And he said, yes. So that was one piece of help. But I agree, they could have done more. A couple points, you know, I guess what I found disappointing about the testimony that they should have brought out more is he's not saying the president's exonerated. He says we need more information. But I just don't know what more information we need. We have the readout of the phone call, and we have the information about what happened corroborated by David Holmes and by Fiona Hill and by Ambassador Sondland. And that's a rock solid case. Now, if you think there are holes in it, then say why. But he just didn't do that. And I thought he should have been called out on that more.
So to my mind, the strongest case is, of course, the one that has been made and the one that Michael Gerhardt, professor at the University of North Carolina, said, which is, if what we're talking about is not impeachable, then nothing is impeachable. And, of course, the conclusion of the Senate Intelligence Report, which was just handed to the Judiciary Committee, is pretty much along the lines that if you don't act in the face of such clear abuse of power on the part of President Trump, then our job as a separate branch of government in terms of checks and balances, we're essentially neutering ourselves in the future and weakening the separation of powers.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, it was a great point that he made, which is if this is not impeachable, then what is? And do you want to send a message to future presidents? So, as you said, the subtitle of the book is A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. That is a paraphrase of a Republican member of Congress saying we need to impeach this president, meaning Nixon. Republican member saying of the Judiciary Committee saying that in order to send a message to future presidents that your power is not unlimited. You can't get away with abusing power. And not impeaching would do the inverse. It would say anything goes and would be a serious danger, I think, to the future of the Republic.
So what do you think, though, given how intense the partisanship is today, and I believe it's a deliberate tactic on the part of the Republicans to make it more partisan, so in order to just tire people and tune them out and say, oh, this is just another squabble between a bunch of warring politicians, this is just the beginning. Sometime in a month or so, we'll have a trial in the Senate. Do you think we're going to last the distance if this is the tone that's been set?
I think we've got to persevere. And, you know, what you and I are doing right now and every time we talk is we're trying to, you know, work together with the American people to see through the BS. And there is a lot of that on the Republican side, the obfuscation, the avoidance of facts, and the avoidance of the deep duty to remove this president. So, you know, is it going to be hard? Are people going to be tired? Yes, of course they are. I'm no, from talking to people, they're exhausted. But we got to remember, we're exhausted from a president that's abusing power. And the second that we get too exhausted to fight him, he wins. And that's unacceptable. The danger is too vast to allow that to happen. So when we remind ourselves of that, I think it'll give us the energy to see through the BS that the Republicans are presenting on this committee and that they will likely present in the Senate as well.
But aren't the Republicans literally following Trump's cue? Because Trump's basically doing government by stunt. He doesn't know what he's doing. And every day he pulls off a stunt to distract the public and the press follow the bright shining light down a rabbit hole. And whenever things go bad, which, you know, they do on a daily basis, he makes an incredibly outrageous remark, which he's been doing at the NATO conference and making these outrageous insults and talking trash about Adam Schiff and world leaders like Macron and Trudeau, etc. All of this stuff grabs the headlines. So I wish that press wouldn't keep taking the bait.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's exhausting us, and he doesn't get tired evidently, because he gets a thrill possibly from any coverage, and good or bad, you know, he's going to keep going. But I guess, you know, shows like yours and the others on your station, and there are a number of others around the country, just have to continue to not be duped and to talk to the American people about what's really happening. I mean, I don't see an alternative, because he'll keep using his strategy. And we're in a new culture where he can bypass the media and speak to the American public himself through Twitter. And the only way to fight back is by providing good information to people and speaking the truth and calling him out on it, not just doing horse race analysis, which of course you don't do, and talk about what's right and restore the values of the American Constitution in the way that we know we ought to. Now, imagine, you know, the Nixon era impeachment turned out differently and Nixon won. We'd live in a totally different world. That's what we're facing right now, is the possibility that somebody worse, actually, than Nixon can win this time.
Well, just in closing, do you think that the framing of particularly of the Ukraine case in terms of the actual Constitution itself, which delineates treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors, the fact that bribery has been injected, and I thought it was, you know, to me it seems like a clear-cut case. That, to me, is what I've been sort of trying to suggest, is that there's got to be a way to simplify this and engage the American people.
Right.
And I think that's
right.
What these legal scholars, at least the three that the Democrats chose, were trying to do. Do you think labeling as bribery is helpful?
I think it can be, but it comes both with a danger and an opportunity. And again, here, as you can tell, I'm a big Pam Carlin fan. I think she really did an amazing job of explaining that to the committee as they consider whether or not to make bribery one of the hooks here for the impeachment, one of the kind of core of one of the articles of impeachment. And what she said is, you know, the idea of impeachment is about high crimes and misdemeanors, abuse of power, and bribery is listed as one example of that. But you don't want to get into a trap of thinking that the contemporary criminal violation of bribery is what we're talking about. We're using bribery in a much broader sense to mean, you know, a president who solicits a favor for his own person from a foreign power, that kind of abuse of power, that's the kind of bribery that they were talking about. There are modern kind of definitions of bribery in the criminal law that are much narrower, and she was warning the committee to be leery of those. And so I thought that was excellent. I wasn't sure if it was too subtle a point. I hope it wasn't. You're certainly making it, and I'm making it, and hopefully your listeners will as well. So, yes, use bribery, but don't get into the trap of listing it in a way that's distinct from the notion of abuse of power.
Right. Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, as always. Thank you for the public service you're providing of getting us through what's going on here. It's a difficult period of history, but I'm an optimist and think we'll get through it.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Corey Bretschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writing has appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times, and he's the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware the South is yours. Oh, 1984. Come see, remember me.
Daddy, daddy, all night moving round. You said it would last, but I guess we grow in 1984.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is John Storr, who's a contributing writer at The Washington Monthly and the editor and publisher of The Editorial Board, a daily newsletter about politics in plain English for the common good, where he just wrote the article, When Does Ordinary Republican Partisanship Turn into Treason? Welcome to Background Briefing, John Storr.
Thank you.
So the partisanship over trying to support Trump's CrowdStrike conspiracy theory about Ukraine being responsible for hacking into the DNC, into Hillary's emails, into John Podesta, et cetera, to tip the election for Donald Trump. I mean, I wish somebody on the Democratic side would at least point out the absurdity of this conspiracy theory, because at the end of the day, it has Hillary Clinton working with the FBI to put a server in Ukraine that's owned by a Ukrainian billionaire that doesn't exist, whose job is to leak the emails from the DNC, from John Podesta, and then turn them over to WikiLeaks to damage Hillary Clinton and thwart her chances of being elected, which is what happened. The only problem is that it was the Russians who did it, not the Ukrainians. But that's what I find puzzling. Do you think the Democrats in the next few days will at least point that absurdity out?
Yeah, I mean, they're focused right now on just getting the first impeachment report out to the Judiciary Committee. I think they will, especially now that the House Republicans are basically all in on this fake story. So, I mean, the idea, if Rudy Giuliani is any indication, is that they can, instead of saying the president didn't do something, they can say the Ukrainians did do something. And so they're hoping to argue in the positive in a way that will exonerate the president. So I want all of your listeners to know that all of this, if this sounds crazy and absurd, it's because it is crazy and absurd. And that is the nature of disinformation and propaganda. It's supposed to make things hard to figure out. The Republicans are already very good at propaganda, and they're taking a Russian lie and turning it up to 11 for their own benefit. Basically, take every accusation against this president and swap in Hillary Clinton, and that's what they want everyone to believe. They want everyone to believe that Trump is the original victim and he will be the ultimate hero in this crime against the United States. And it's exactly the kind of story that all authoritarians around the world have ever told about themselves. They say to themselves that they are the true avatars of the popular will, and that anybody who's against them is against the popular will. And so, and to protect and to honor and serve the popular will, they are willing to do anything, even if it's to, you know, destroy norms, destroy institutions, destroy the rule of law, anything, as long as they can stay in power. The other thing I want to say is that we're very accustomed now to calling this the story of the Ukraine attacking the United States as a conspiracy theory. We have to, all of us, you, me, Ian, and everybody, we need to be very careful when we say that, use those words, conspiracy theory, because the tendency is to say it's a conspiracy theory, so let's just dismiss it. It's not true, so why pay attention to it? It is a conspiracy theory, but it is one being used to obliterate the truth, right? And to rewrite the history of the 2016 presidential election in order to wound the president's enemies, meaning the Democrats, and to help his friends, meaning him and Vladimir Putin, as far as I can tell. So it's not just a conspiracy theory in the sense that, like, oh, he just doesn't really know what he's talking about. No, this is intent. This is has a purpose. It's intentional and it's malicious.
But can you disarm this tactic mm-hmm. by pointing out the utter absurdity of it? Because at the end of the day, if you believe this CrowdStrike
scenario that the Republicans are putting out, that Trump's putting out, that Senator Kennedy is repeating, that even the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who seemed like a reasonable guy, hasn't ruled it out, not necessarily endorsing it. Lindsey Graham said he hadn't heard any evidence about it. Mitt Romney has said there's no evidence. It's clearly there's evidence against Russia, but not against Ukraine. There's been some pushback from some Republicans, but by and large, it is the Republican talking point at the moment, and they'll keep hammering away at it. But my sense is that it could be disarmed through humor to point out the utter absurdity. At the end of the day, they are saying that Hillary Clinton conspired with Ukraine to defeat herself.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the kind of like John Stewart approach to you know, flesh out the absurdity of it, and there's something to that. You know, I think there's utility, political utility, to ridicule. I do see that, but I don't think it can end there. I think you need to say a lie is a lie, you know, and I think, you know, the way you combat a lie is to say that's a lie. And you say, and then you say what the truth is. Mm-hmm. They're going to come back and say that you're a liar too, and that, you know, fine, whatever. But you, people who are telling the truth have the truth on their side. They have the evidence. They have the moral imperative to tell the truth as well. We're stuck right now. I think the Washington Press Corps is kind of stuck right now. It doesn't really know how to handle voluminous and malicious lying like this. It just, the most productive thing the Washington Press Corps can do right now is to do fact checking. And that's good. I think that's really good. But you can point out, you can fact check all day long and still never keep up with the lies, right? I really think the Press Corps and also just normal Americans, they need to understand how destructive lying is when it becomes the currency of the public square. You know, it's so corrosive, you know, to the end. And if nobody can figure out what's true, then nobody can be held to account. You know, and so going back to the press corps, I believe that somehow reporters really need to reclaim their stake in a democracy. Basically, like, de-emphasize the fact-checking and re-emphasize holding power to account. The fact-checking is not holding power to account. It's just not. So find another way. You have to basically just have no tolerance for lying, you know, within the public square. That means CNN has to really not be CNN anymore. It has to, like, stop inviting Sean Duffy on to lie, and Corey Lewandowski to lie, and et cetera, et cetera. You have to not only check facts, you have to deplatform the liars, you know, just exclude them completely.
And again, I'm speaking with John Storr, who's a contributing writer at the Washington Monthly and the editor and publisher of the editorial board, a daily newsletter about politics in plain English for the common good, where he just wrote the article, "When Does Ordinary Republican Partisanship Turn into Treason?" Yesterday, John, in response to the BBC running a documentary about Prince Andrew witnessing the young women that Epstein trafficked for his Andrew's use, they described in detail what happened to them. It's apparently even more devastating than the dreadful interview that he did with the BBC. But the interesting part was that yesterday when they asked President Trump at the NATO summit, sitting next to the Prime Minister of Canada, Trudeau, he said, I don't know Prince Andrew, you know. There's endless pictures, endless newsreel pictures of him with Andrew. There's even pictures of him at Mar-a-Lago standing next to Prince Andrew with guess who in the background, Jeffrey Epstein. Right. It's as though Trump's first instinct is to lie. That's what I find extraordinary, that he's much more comfortable telling lies than he is the truth.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, and there's here's the way I understand somebody who lies like that. for normal people like you and me and all of your listeners, we have some degree of respect for facts and for the truth. Meaning, we may have an opinion about the weather, but we're not going to argue whether the weather is what it is. You know, it's sunset here in Connecticut. The sun is out. It's beautiful. I might be in a terrible mood, but there's no disputing the sun being out. That's for normal people. But people like Trump, what's true is what he says. There is no deference to the authority of facts. You see, because there's no authority independent of his own ego. So in his own mind, and I think he's even said something to this effect, in his own mind, it's true. You know, it's not a lie, because he said it. You know, when facts do not exist independent of your own ego and your own self-interest, then there's no such thing as a falsehood. Everything you say is true. And I think there's something to that about him. And this is also why he cannot tolerate disagreement. Somebody who believes that there is no authority independent of his own ego will see another person with a different point of view as not simply someone in disagreement, but a traitor. That person's a traitor. You're not loyal to me because you are saying something that's contrary to what I think is the truth. I think a lot of normal people, and I think especially liberals, do not understand this kind of mentality because they've never encountered it in their whole lives. You know, it just seems so bizarre. And it is bizarre. And they're not wrong. But there are lots of people in this country who cannot tolerate disagreement, because disagreement is conflict or disagreement is betrayal. That's why you have so many people who apologize when they disagree about things. Oh, I'm sorry, I disagree, but I really do have a point of view, etc. Liberals are like, yeah, sure you disagree. Who cares? Show me why you disagree. You know, that's what how liberals tend to function. At least they do here on the East Coast. Well. And so it's a bizarre thing. But I think liberals really have to understand that mentality in order just to make sense of it all.
Well, is that to say then, John Stewart, that we don't need political analysts anymore in the age of Trump? We need psychiatrists?
Yes.
So you're out of business.
No.
So let me ask you there, you mentioned the weather in Connecticut. The Democratic Senator from Connecticut, Chris Murphy, who's the leading Democrat in the Senate on foreign affairs, and frankly, I wish he was running for president because he's the most qualified, electable, smart, certainly the strongest on foreign policy, and yet we've got this train wreck going on. But nevertheless, that's not the subject I want to talk to you about. But what Chris Murphy just said, I think a couple of days ago, was that similar to what your article, which is titled "When Does Ordinary Republican Partisanship Turn into Treason?" he's more or less saying that the Republican Party have turned into the kind of asset of Putin's, not just Trump, but the Republican Party itself. And that's really extraordinary because this guy's in the know. What is going on here? We know Trump's a criminal, but getting to the T word, which, by the way, is in the articles of impeachment, in the Constitution, it says treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. Why is it so hard for people to get their head around the T word?
Oh, well, I think there's a really good practical explanation for that. It's the worst thing a president could do. To accuse the president of doing the worst thing, it's like, well, you really better mean it, and there better be a good reason, otherwise it's not worth taking seriously. I think people are very prudent in being cautious about using that word, or in the case of a well-known senator from Connecticut, being careful about, you know, going around the edges. If we get to that point, you will know where things are going when somebody like Murphy starts using treason very carefully and deliberately, you will know something has really shifted. Because the distance you got to go from here to there is pretty enormous. And at the same time, things are coming to light where it's like so obvious, right? It's like, well, of course it's treason. I mean, when you extort a foreign leader in order to defraud the American people, well, there you go. That's betrayal. That's treason. You could say, well, we're not in a time of war, but then you could also say, yes, we are in a time of war because the Cold War never ended for Russia. It ended for us, but it didn't for them. I mean, that's a fact.
Well, hybrid warfare they've adopted, which is actually more effective than the Cold War in the sense that you can actually be aggressive in hybrid warfare through information war.
That's right.
And that's where they're so active and where so much on our back foot. And this whole thing about Ukraine is information warfare. And you got the Republican Party repeating the Kremlin's talking points.
Yeah. What if you mentioned a minute ago about why the Democrats don't do something. The one thing I wish there was more of, and there are good reasons why the Democrats don't do this, but I wish there was a Democrat that said, we're at war. We're at war right now. We were attacked. This is a variation of September 11th. The reason you don't hear Democrats say that is because among Democrats, that would be that would just be a non-starter because there are so many anti-war Democrats, period. And there's a lot of anti-Americanism within the Democratic Party, too. And by that, I mean, you know, we do bad things in the world, so let's not talk about going to war. Let's talk about being a better country, that kind of thing. But we are. I mean, right now it's a one-sided, quiet cyber war, and we have a president whose first job is national defense. That's his first job, right? And so even just in being passive to an ongoing information assault, this president is betraying our country and is committing impeachable acts. Unfortunately, the Democrats aren't there yet, and maybe they will at some point. I think there is a Cold War going on, or maybe we should call it a quiet war. You know, something of that. That's what's going on right now, and not just in our country, but in a variety of places. We tend to attribute the rise of fascism in places like Hungary and Italy and France and as if it were a reaction to globalization only. It isn't a reaction to globalization, but it's not only to that. It's also because Russia is polluting the public sphere. It is creating conditions in which people cannot make heads or tails of anything, and so what they do is they pledge allegiance to the leader, and that's not good for democracy.
Well, a perfect example of that information warfare being such a powerful political tool is Brexit. I mean, my God, it's paralyzed the Brits. They're going to have an election coming up in a couple of weeks on the 12th of December and likely to elect Boris Johnson, and the Brexit agony won't end. It'll get worse because he'll actually do Brexit. And then it'll bring down the British economy. It may slow down Europe and we may lead to a global recession. So for a £9 million investment that Putin made through an FSB prostitute who was kicked out of the Emirates, who ended up marrying a British insurance magnate who was the major donor to Brexit, not a bad investment on Putin's part. Because I was in the UK recently and they are more divided than we are. As bad as it is here, they are even more divided, and that is exactly what information warfare strategy is about. It's dividing people and conquering them through that division and without firing a shot. So congratulations, Vladimir. You're doing a hell of a job.
You might want to end with this, but something that George Orwell said in one of his many pages of writing really stuck with me all this time. He said something to the effect that disinformation and propaganda is worse than a bomb. You know, the bombs don't scare me, he said. What scares me is when people can't figure out what's up and down, left and right anymore. What scares me is the mass insanity. I don't think those were his words, but the idea that everybody's insane. It's because propaganda will make you feel insane. You know, politics is already hard enough to figure out anyway. You really have to be a student of politics to understand it. But then you add, you know, an influence campaign from a hostile foreign power, and it becomes that much more incoherent. So I agree with George Orwell. It's just very scary.
Well, John Storer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much.
And again, I've been speaking with John Storer, who's a contributing writer at The Washington Monthly and the publisher of The Editorial Board, a daily newsletter about politics in plain English for the common good, where he just wrote the article, "When Does Ordinary Republican Partisanship Turn into Treason?"
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Clare, a Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And his latest book just out is All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Clare.
Pleasure to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Michael. And just to touch on the report that came out today from the Global Carbon Project, the world has lost another year to reduce carbon emissions. In fact, 2019 is an increase. Global warming gas emissions have grown slightly, reaching another record high. And the year, of course, is not quite over. The total emissions from fossil fuels and industry totaled 36.8 billion tons, and that's up 0.6% from 2018. So we're heading in the wrong direction, and not surprised given the leadership we have and the priorities of Trump and the people he's working for, which are largely the fossil fuels companies. And then, of course, the other connection is that we are talking here today when Nancy Pelosi and a delegation of Democrats are in Madrid at the COP25 climate change conference, at which on Friday, Greta Thunberg, who has just sailed across the Atlantic to Madrid, will be leading a demonstration on Friday. So there you have the two sides of it, in effect. You've got an alarming report saying we're not going in the right direction, and we know that we only have a small window to reverse things. And two, you've got one of the leading climate protesters or human extinction protesters out there who has galvanized a whole younger generation. So there's the despair and there's a hope. Then there's your book, which I think is incredibly important, Michael, because in this country, the military is one of the few last institutions that the broad cross-section in this divided country respect the military. So if we can somehow, as your book does, cut through the denial nonsense and get people to recognize how the Pentagon is seeing what's happening and how they're preparing for it, and also how they are actually adapting and trying to deal with the reality of climate change. So again, I put that in the category of hope as opposed to despair. So I know I've given a speech here instead of asking you a question, but the first question would be, Is that why you wrote the book, to essentially make people aware of how dangerous the situation is, but also aware of the institution that they trust is actually dealing with it in a realistic way?
Well, I think it did a good job, Ian, of capturing the intent, my intent in writing the book. First of all, I found in searching through Pentagon documents and my interviews with people in the military and retired officers a very distinctive picture of climate change that you don't always hear from environmentalists and climate scientists, which is to say, people in the military view climate change not only as a threat to habitats and to species, endangered species, but they also see climate change as a very severe threat to the survival of human societies. They see that climate change is going to very rapidly, in fact, already, is causing the breakdown of societies in vulnerable parts of the world, in Africa and the Middle East, where resources are scarce and where people fight over things like food and water. In this environment, climate change is going to make conflict much more likely, producing mass migrations, pandemics, state collapse, chaos, all of which, of course, will bring the military into the picture in a way that they prefer not to have to deal with. So for them, climate change is a very severe threat to global stability. And I think this picture is something that is not often discussed in the environmental community, in the scientific community, but adds to our picture of just how threatening climate change is going to prove to be in the years ahead.
Well, as you point out, that Pentagon officials fear that essential resources will dwindle in many poor and divided countries, provoking conflict among internal factions and threatening the survival of fragile governments. In this chaotic environment, terrorist groups will flourish, while dispossessed farmers will migrate in search of jobs, typically encountering hostility wherever they go. All this instability will result in deadly pandemics, incessant warfare, and a relentless call on the United States to provide humanitarian relief and troop support. But you have to add to that that what the chaos that will be happening abroad will also be happening here, because ocean rises will swamp a lot of the East Coast, particularly Florida and the barrier islands off the Carolinas. It will be so hot in Arizona and Nevada that people can't live there. So we'll have internal migrations, maybe 10, 20 million people moving within the United States. So the picture is so extraordinarily bleak. And yet my hope is, and I guess it's your hope, Michael, that somehow people will start listening to the military types who are tasked with the reality of facing a threat. This not a military threat in a sense, but a global threat which endangers us at all.
Yes, and the military faces this not only in terms of the missions that they will be forced to undertake. So when you speak of all the threats to Florida and the rest of the country from rising sea levels and from extreme storms, in all of these cases, the military will be called out increasingly in the future to engage in what they call defense support for civilian authorities, DISCA operations, where they will be providing relief and emergency assistance activities. They see this more and more take a part of their mission in the future as the United States itself comes under assault from climate change. But compounding the problem from their perspective is the fact that many of their own installations, bases and installations, are themselves at severe risk from climate change. Many of their most important naval bases, for example, are up and down the east coast of the United States, from Florida into the Carolinas and especially in Virginia, where Norfolk Naval Station, the largest naval base in the world, is right squarely in the crosshairs of climate change, both from rising sea levels and extreme storm damage. And they understand fully well that as climate change advances, these bases are going to become inoperable. And so they face a double challenge of protecting the nation from increasingly severe risks at a time when their own facilities may not be available to them. So they have a very clear-eyed notion of the threat posed by climate change. And I think this message, if brought to the public and hopefully to Congress, can alter the debate in this country away from partisan bickering to a notion that we face a threat akin to war and that we have to rally together to take urgent steps to reduce the threat posed by climate change.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, a Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. He's the author of Blood and Oil and The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And his latest book just out is All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. And it obviously got close to home in terms of the Pentagon in the recent hurricane in Florida that trashed the Pensacola base. And they managed to get some of the F-22 stealth fighters out before the hurricane hit, but there were a bunch of them because they're so damn expensive and they have to be maintained and they're a bunch of hangar queens, as they call them. A lot of F-22s were trashed along with the hangars, and these are extremely expensive airplanes. So it's already happening, isn't it, the destruction of these bases?
Absolutely. In the past year alone, from beginning with Hurricane Florence of about a year ago, which destroyed much of Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, suffered $3 billion in damage. Then a month later, Hurricane Michael in Florida, that's the one you're referring to, which destroyed Tyndall Air Force Base in the Florida Panhandle, another $3 to $4 billion worth of damage, including those F-22s. And then earlier this year, during one of those cyclone bombs that we're hearing about, occurred across the Upper Midwest, causing immense flooding of the Missouri River, and the flooding overtook Offutt Air Force Base, the headquarters of the Strategic Air Command, no less, flooding that base entirely, causing another $3 or $4 billion in damage. That's just, it doesn't include all the planes and the equipment. So that gives you an example. That's just 1 year, three bases, $10 billion or more worth of damage, and it's unclear whether those bases will ever be restored to their full operational capacity as they were before.
So do you think, just getting back to the where I see the value in what you've written here, was cutting through this argument, and particularly the possibility of getting the denialists to recognize reality, is because the Pentagon has to deal with reality, and you can't have fake news in the Pentagon because, you know, lives depend upon it, and somebody's in the field makes up a story or calls in coordinates that aren't real coordinates or that aren't the accurate ones, and instead of defending a bunch of troops, they blow up a kindergarten. It's an intensely reality-based community, is it not, the military?
Yes, you put it right. They can operate on fake news. The people I've spoken to in the military in preparation for writing this book are, as you say, reality based. They operate on the basis of logic. They have to know what is the environment in which American troops are going to be deployed or asked to risk their lives. They have to know, is the environment changing? What are the climatic conditions they are going to face in the years ahead. And this is very serious, and they're very concerned. For example, it's very clear from scientific studies that temperatures in the Middle East, in the greater Middle East, are likely to exceed 110 degrees Fahrenheit from now on in the summertime during the heat of the day, and probably in many areas exceed 120 degrees Fahrenheit for long stretches of time. You can't put a soldier out there with 60 or 80 pounds of gear into that condition and expect them to carry out their function. People die under those conditions. So they're very aware that climate change is going to alter the battlefield in very significant ways. They also are aware that the Arctic is changing dramatically. The Arctic is the northern frontier of the United States. There was once covered with ice, making it impossible for ships to operate there to pose a threat from that direction. Now the ice cap is melting, and the Arctic is becoming an open ocean in which Russia and China are now sending their ships. So the Navy has a whole new ocean to operate in, and we're unprepared for that. So the Navy has to address climate change in that respect. They can't ignore it. They can't go pretend that there's no such thing as climate change.
Well, Michael Clare, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Ian. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Michael. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program on Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include Blood and Oil, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And his latest book, just that, is All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the